So today, for our Friday Forum webinar, we welcome UVA alum Ann Emery. Ann Emery, who graduated from the college in 2008, double majored in psychology and Spanish, and gained data skills while working as an undergraduate research assistant for professors across multiple psychology, public policy, and education schools and departments here at UVA. After graduating, she put her skills into use as a researcher at the Charlottesville Albemarle Commission on Children and Families, ICF International, the Latin American Youth Center, and Innovation Network. Last year, Anne launched her own consulting firm and now equips organizations to communicate their data more effectively. She leads more than 50 workshops and webinars each year about Excel, Tableau, dashboard design, and spreadsheet skills. Anne is the co-chair of the American Evaluation Association's Data Visualization and Reporting Interest Group and secretary for the Washington Evaluators. Please welcome Anne Emery with Communicating Your Data Effectively Through Graphs.
Great. Thanks so much. Hi, everybody. I'm Anne. I'm glad that you're joining us for the webinar today. So let's go ahead and dive in and talk about communicating data more effectively, or data visualization, or data viz for short. Here's what we're going to cover today. I'm going to walk you through the five-step data visualization design process. This is the critical thinking process that I go through in all of my projects when I'm creating some type of graph or dashboard. So I think about my audience, how I'm going to share my chart, which chart I need to use, you know, the pie chart or the bar chart or maybe something else altogether. I think about which software tool I'm going to use, and finally, which formatting edits that I'll need to make. You're going to learn a lot over the next hour, but you're not going to learn everything. This isn't the be-all, end-all. It's kind of the 60-minute quick introduction to the field. So after today's webinar, I hope you feel inspired to go out and continue learning. You might see the section on color and say, okay, that's something I'm really interested in. I'm going to go dive into color theory some more. Or you might see a new graph type that you want to learn more about and go dive into that. Okay, so let's get started. Data visualization 101. Here's what it is. It's charts, graphs, diagrams, everything in this kind of visual family that's designed to take all of your big spreadsheets of data and crunch them down and deliver just the most important messages to your audience. It's the opposite of this, the narrative text-based report. I hope you don't have to write these too often. I used to work in a lot of qualitative research labs, and I had to write these all the time. We'd go on and on and on for 100 pages in our report with no pictures whatsoever. Hopefully you don't have to read these. I'm not sure if people read these anymore. I'm sure they open the PDF. They probably skim the document. But whether they actually read every single word, I don't know. I doubt it. And I think this is why people are inundated with information these days, so much information overload. Hopefully your office doesn't look like this with the actual, you know, exploding filing cabinet that this woman had. But I know we've got Dropbox folders, Google Drive. People are emailing us all the time, of course. Our inboxes are overflowing. And these days we've got more data than we can really handle or know what to do with. Okay, so data viz to the rescue. I'll show you a couple examples of how this works. So let's say your organization is trying to get out the message that whales are huge. They're these wonderful creatures worth protecting and worth saving. So you could write up a couple paragraphs in your report that would look something like this. Or you could show a photograph of a huge whale next to a tiny scuba diver. It's pretty obvious that the picture is a lot more memorable than just the text alone. And the picture with the text together are really strong. Let's say your organization is working on some type of nutrition campaign and you're trying to get out the message that soda is really bad for you, it's got a lot of sugar, it's no good for your health. So same thing, you could write a couple paragraphs in your report and talk about how soda is really, really bad for you and all its sugar content. Or you could create some type of graphic that compared how much sugar is in the soda bottles compared to the banana. Data visualization people like me would call this a unit chart because we know that each unit of sugar, each one of those sugar cubes has 15 calories. So if you wanted to, you could even count up the number of sugar cubes there, or you can just estimate it pretty quickly. We would also call the banana there contextual data or comparison data because it allows you to make the comparisons between the Coke and the banana. Okay, one more example. So let's say your organization is running some type of conference or convening or annual meeting, and your goal is to attract people from all over the country to come to this meeting. So you could write up a couple paragraphs about who was present at your event or maybe who wasn't. Or you could just create a simple map where now the states that are blue show where people came from and the gray ones are where you need to still attract people from. It's pretty easy to see right off the bat that the western states were not at attendance at your convening, and now you know exactly who to reach out to when planning next year's event. Data visualization combines a few different skill sets, so it's part graphic design, part data and statistics. I think this is what makes the field so interesting. It's truly interdisciplinary because nobody has gone to school or graduate school for both of these paths. You know, nobody specializes in graphic design and data and statistics. So you see a lot of times these multidisciplinary teams, multi-person teams, teaming up to do the work. Data visualization can be exploratory or explanatory. Exploratory would be when you're sitting in your staff meeting and you're looking at the numbers and you're sketching some trends on the whiteboard or on a piece of paper. Or maybe you're exploring on your computer with spark bars or spark lines, which I've shown here. Explanatory is when you've got your fully formatted chart that's ready to go inside of your PowerPoint slide or inside of your report. Data visualization might be one single chart or a collage of several charts for a dashboard or an infographic or some type of handout. And finally, data visualization can be static or interactive. Most of the examples you'll see today are static, meaning that they live inside of my PowerPoint slide or they're screenshots from the inside of my Word document. Some of the graphs these days that are really exciting, they're interactive, so they live inside of a database or some type of computer program, or they live inside of a website. This is my favorite one. It was created by the New York Times. It's called Mapping America, Every City, Every Block. I'll zoom in on that so you can see it a little bit better. So it's this website. You know, if you want to check it out, you can Google it now or after the webinar, and you get to scroll over different neighborhoods. So sometimes people like to explore the neighborhood that they grew up in or maybe the neighborhood they're living now. You could check out Charlottesville if you wanted. Right now we're looking at the New York City area, so you can kind of see Central Park there, the little tilted rectangle to the side where nobody was counted census-wise. Each of the dots represents 200 people, so you can see which neighborhoods are more densely populated. And it's also color-coded by race and ethnicity, so you can see where different groups of people are living. Regardless of whether you're making a static or interactive graphic, the same principles apply. So the same principles about text, color, layout, graph type are all the same. Okay, so after Crash Course webinars, people always ask me to recommend some resources for getting started. So here's your resource slide. These are the names that you want to write down. These are the people that I partner with most often and that I've learned the most from. At the top, we've got the pioneers, Edward Tufte, Hans Rosling, and Stephen Few. Edward Tufte has pretty much the books on data visualization. So if you're going to read any books after today's webinar, go check out one of his. He's got four out. You could read any one of them and learn a lot. Hans Rosling is my personal DataViz crush. He's a superstar on YouTube. He has a lot of TED Talks out. A lot of them have been recorded. All of his YouTube videos have millions and millions of views, so you might recognize him already from the internet. Stephen Few is really big in the business analytics world, so if you want to learn more about creating dashboards, especially in a for-profit or corporate setting, he has a huge book. It's kind of a textbook-sized book about everything you would ever want to know about dashboards. In the middle, I've got this kind of new segment of people that's popping up, the data journalists. So we've got Andy Kirk. He's based out in the UK. He's the first person that I personally know of to go out on his own and kind of create this career path of data visualization. I think he left his journalism job, I want to say in 2011 or 12, so it wasn't that long ago. The field's pretty young, and now does this work independently. Does a lot of freelance and teaching work. Alberto Cairo, you might have heard of. He's a professor at the University of Miami, and he also teaches the MOOC about data visualization, the massive open online course each year that attracts 10 or 20 or 30,000 students. And then also we've got the data journalism teams at major newspapers, like the New York Times graphics team and the Washington Post graphics team. Each of these teams employs 10 or 20 or 30 different people who focus on this every single day. This is their main job, is to create graphics for the everyday people. And then at the bottom, I've got my partners in crime, the practitioners turned trainers and authors. Cole Nussbaumer has an HR background. She used to be at Google before she went out on her own a couple years ago. Stephanie Evergreen has a really similar background as me, social sciences, program evaluation. She was also an elementary school teacher for a while. Then we've got me, so I've got my research background, program evaluation, kind of social science slant. And John Schwabish, who's got more of a policy economics background. He works right now at the Urban Institute, but we joke that we're going to pull him into the self-employed club any day now. Okay, so here's step one of that five-step process. The very first thing you're going to do is think about your audience. Who are you creating these graphs for? That's the absolute most important consideration. Here are some of the people that I produce graphs for that you might produce graphs for. So it might be somebody within your organization. You could be making graphs for your boss, maybe for the executive director or president of the company, maybe for just some type of upper-level manager, a board of directors, a board of trustees. It could be some type of government agency or funder or prospective funder for your group. Maybe you're making graphs for the general public to go in some type of brochure or a website. Or maybe you have clients. If you're a consultant, you're probably creating graphs for your clients. If you work in a nonprofit or in a school setting, these would be your stakeholders or the people that you serve on an everyday basis, the people who you're accountable to. I ask myself a few different questions about each of these groups. So I think, of course, about what types of decisions do they make? What type of information do I need to provide in the graph? What's the right level? You know, do I need the bird's eye view information? Do I need really, really detailed, nitty-gritty information? That's going to vary for every single project. I also think about their numeracy levels. So of course, there's an obvious difference in what type of information a group of statisticians would need compared to a group of economists, compared to a group of, say, PTA leaders or school leaders or school board leaders. And I also think about their prior experience with data visualization. This is a pretty big one. So if they are brand new to this whole kind of concept and field that there's, you know, kind of this correct, effective way to produce graphs, I'm probably going to stick with traditional chart types like a pie chart or a bar chart or a line chart. But if the group I'm working with is really familiar with data visualization, maybe they're creating a lot of graphs in-house or they have a lot of graphs on their website already, I get to be a little bit more experimental and use some novel chart types. So I might use something like a dot plot or a tree map, which you'll see in a few minutes. And I also think about how much time and interest they have. So of course, if somebody is really invested in the data, I can produce a really lengthy report. I may produce a website that they can drill down on the data themselves and explore at their own pace. But if they only have a couple minutes, I'm probably producing something like a one-page handout to share at a meeting. Okay, so here's your chance to weigh in and participate a little bit. Use the chat window and let me know who your audience is. What types of people or organizations are you currently producing graphs for, if any? And hopefully we'll see probably a pretty wide variety among all the participants. Tamara says architects. Okay, that's a new one. Managers, adult students, students in classes, healthcare providers, board of directors, C-level executives, higher ed leaders, grocery retailers, okay, voters, academic researchers, teachers, engineers and management. Great, so a whole wide variety there. So hopefully you can apply the thinking questions that I showed on the previous slide to your own audiences. Venture capitalists, journal writers, brand managers, wow, everything. Okay, so let's go into step two of five. How are you going to share your charts? What type of dissemination format? What type of communication mode? So this is what we're avoiding. We're not doing this, the traditional narrative text-based report. We're going to put people to sleep if all of our reports look like this. So think of this as one end of the spectrum. And now I'm going to show you something at the very other end of the spectrum. So at the other end would be the fully visual report. What you're looking at right now is a report that I worked on a couple of years ago when I still worked at Innovation Network. It's called the State of Evaluation Report. It's about how many nonprofits use data as a part of their everyday work. And you're looking at full-page spreads from a kind of a published document like that. This one is about 80% graphics, 20% text, so it is, you know, at the other end of the spectrum. I'm not saying you have to jump from one end to the other overnight, but there's probably some middle ground that's going to work for you and for your viewers. Handouts. Okay, so this is what you are not going to do. You're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to go to your staff meeting, to your client meeting, to your board of directors meeting with all of your data and your slides and just hand them a handout that looks like this where you've got 4 or 6 slides printed out. No way. That's going to be information overload. All again, they've got too much information. You have to pare it down for them. These types of handouts get thrown away almost instantly after meetings. You probably do it too. They go right in the recycling bin. So here's what you're going to do instead. You're going to think about the 3 or 5 key findings, the main graphs that you shared in that meeting or in that presentation, and you're going to print those slides out in like a full page layout. So you might even use really large paper. This exact one is 11 by 17 paper. You can see how massive it is compared to that tiny pen on the right-hand side. What I usually do is I'll work with groups over time. So I may work with them and go see them every month or every quarter. And as I'm going back to them, you know, a couple months later, I see these taped on the wall above their desk. They save these handouts. They jot notes down on them. They keep them. They're kind of these treasures of data because I've done the hard work for them and already filtered out what the key findings are that they need to focus on, whereas the other ones we know end up right in the recycling bin. So try this technique in your own work. Let me know how it goes. It'll probably work really, really well, especially if you're using kind of the slide style handout. Another communications mode that you might try is a dashboard. Dashboards and infographics are very different. People sometimes use the terms interchangeably, so I'm going to show you how they're different. So the two things that distinguish dashboards are that they're produced in a series. So you might make one every week or every month or every quarter or every year. And second, they're for internal audiences and internal decision-making within kind of one organization, housed in the same group. So this example, I'm on the board of the Washington Evaluators. That's a professional society for people who do my type of social science research in the DC area. And this is our kind of annual report, annual dashboard that we give out to our members and that we use ourselves for our board decision-making. So that's where the internal audience comes from. And we're producing this every single year, kind of updating it. So it's in a series that gets that kind of dashboard definition. They don't have to be on one page. Sometimes a dashboard could be 2 pages or 3 pages, but it is supposed to focus on just the key metrics. Infographics, on the other hand, they're not produced in a series. They're more of a one-time event, so you make them as needed. You might make them once. You might want to update them twice or make a version 1 or a draft and then a version 2 later on. And they're for external audiences. So it's usually an organization that's trying to attract new donors, trying to get the word out about their cause, trying to educate the general public about some issue. They're usually really colorful. You usually hire a graphic designer to make these. They have a lot of vector images, a lot of clip art, lots and lots of, you know, colorful elements in addition to graphs. But the trick here is that they usually violate about 99% of the data visualization best practices. So it's really hard for me to find any that I like. If you find some that you think fit the principles that you're going to see in today's webinar, please send them my way. I'm definitely on the hunt for good examples of infographics. Postcards are another communication mode. They're really gaining traction. I received this one in the mail about a year ago. It was a little like 5x7 glossy postcard. It was made to look kind of handwritten, even though it was clearly made in a computer software program. And it was a writing company advertising their services. I really liked it because I thought it was a little bit more creative than just the typical, you know, ad or junk mail that you would get with stock art or clip art on it. But I've also seen a lot of organizations using this to get out the word about their data and to share their data. So sometimes organizations will they'll pick, you know, 3 or 5 findings from, let's say, from their annual report or a recent report that they issued, and they'll print those key findings on the front of the postcard. And then when you flip it over on the back, you see a URL to the main report. So it kind of grabs people's attention. They might send it to everybody on their mailing list, almost like their Christmas card mailing list, where you're trying to reach out with to people and kind of stay in touch throughout the year. And then anybody who is interested, once you've kind of hooked them in, they might go to your URL and read the full report. Animated videos. Oh, these are my favorite. So this one is by my DataViz crush, Hans Rosling. You can go check it out on YouTube. You might have seen it before. 6 million plus viewers, and I have also enjoyed it. He talks about he's got like 10 or 20,000 data points that he smushes into this 4-minute video. It's really, really well done. If you produce something like this or if you have something like this, please let me know. I think these are incredible ways of sharing data. Okay, so here's an example how step one about audience and step two about communications mode really go hand in hand and work together. So I'm on the board of that Washington Evaluators group that I mentioned, and I'm also the communications committee chair. So I have the super fun volunteer job of producing this monthly report about all of our kind of communications outlets. So how many Twitter followers do we have, or how many website hits do we get, kind of basic stuff that we as a board like to keep track of. So as I was drafting this a couple months ago, I started by thinking about my audience. So audience is number one. And I knew the audience was just the fellow board members, so about the seven of us, that we had very little time to look at this. People might glance at it as it's sent around in the meeting materials packet before our monthly board meeting. And then at the board meeting, I estimated we only had probably 2 minutes to kind of glance at this. We maybe have a couple minutes of a discussion afterwards. So not a lot of time, not a lot of interest. It had to be kind of at a glance information. And I also knew that my viewers were also data-savvy people and that they'd want the raw numbers, so I actually included the actual, you know, data table and all the numbers in case they had questions. Then I thought about communications mode, so I had some real-life, you know, logistical constraints. I knew I'd be printing this from my own office computer, so I wanted it to be one page. I wanted it to print well in black and white. I didn't want a lot of colors in there. And I knew, since I would personally have to produce this every single month, I didn't want to have to copy and paste a million charts back and forth and back and forth from Excel into Word. So that's why I used the spark bars and spark lines shown here, so that the little graphs live within the cell of my Excel spreadsheet that I printed out, and that there would be no copying and pasting. Okay, second chance to share your feedback. So what types of communications modes are you currently using to share your graphs? Are you using mostly the traditional report layout, some type of executive summary, a handout, maybe you're doing a lot of presentations? And which styles might you try in the future? Did you see any new styles just now that have got you kind of motivated to step outside of your comfort zone and try something new? Okay, so we've got people using PowerPoints, executive summary handouts. Yep, those are pretty common, executive summaries too. I produce a lot of those. Somebody says the boring stuff. We're using the boring stuff right now. I totally understand. I'd say 99% of groups are doing the typical stuff. Salesforce dashboards, okay, definitely. A lot of computer programs now have kind of built-in dashboards that let you customize your open kind of home screen to have just the graphs that you want. Monica also says dashboards. Traditionally, PowerPoint, Excel documents, moving to online dashboards, clunky setup. Yeah, it takes a while to get those dashboards set up. They are a huge time investment. Hand drawing on whiteboards of figures. Oh, that's a great one. Analytics dashboards put into Excel. Okay, so pretty dashboard heavy group. Okay, so let's go on to the design process, step three. Which chart are you going to use? So you thought about your audience, you thought about how you're going to be sharing your chart when it's finalized. Now you need to think about which actual chart type. There are probably at least 100 different graph types to choose from. So let's look at just a couple of them now. The first thing that I do when I'm thinking about chart type is I sit down with my actual data set. I usually have it summarized into some type of table, so I'm kind of looking at the bird's eye view summary statistics, and I start sketching by hand. So this is a lot of fun. You get to release your inner kindergartner being a little bit creative, but I purposely step away from my computer. I set the timer on my phone for 30 minutes. Sometimes I try to push myself for an hour, and I graph out all the different possibilities. So before I get kind of overwhelmed with a blank computer screen staring at me, I just sketch on blank paper or on scratch paper. Super important step. So I'll show you how this works. You saw that completed annual dashboard for the Washington Evaluators, but I did not just sit down to my blank computer screen and make it. There was a very careful drafting process that happened behind the scenes. I think I made 8 different drafts of this. So I worked on it on 8 different days, you know, as I was making adjustments. So you can see version 1 over on the left was just my notes from our board meeting where we kind of got the idea to make this dashboard. We started thinking about what metrics we might include. We didn't even know which metrics were really reasonable to include at this point. We were truly just brainstorming for the very first time. In the middle, I've kind of jumped forward to version 3, where I started sketching it out. I knew it would be on a portrait layout. I knew it would be one page at that point. I knew there would be different sections. So I'd have the the title at the top, some type of who we are or demographics about our members, some type of report on activities or what we do, and then, of course, the contact information. So people want to become members or visit our website later, they know how to get in touch with us. And on the right, I showed you version 8, the completed one that I made right inside PowerPoint. No fancy software required. If you want to see all the little drafts that happened between 3 and 8, there's a million ugly versions. I have a blog post about these, about the behind-the-scenes process of creating this annual dashboard. Sometimes I sketch on computer, so I'll use Excel's built-in spark lines and spark bars. Those are miniature within cell bar charts that you can see right here. They're available in Excel 2010 and higher, so if you don't see them, they're under the Insert tab in Excel. Then it's probably just that you're using an older version of Excel and don't have them. They're on Macs and PCs. It would take me a long time to glance at all of those numbers there and read them one by one by one by one by one and find the key findings. So I let Excel do the heavy lifting for me, and I let it help me figure out where the highs are, where the lows are, where like the little peaks and valleys in between are too. Sometimes I also use Excel's conditional formatting features. So conditional formatting is right on the Home tab of Excel. It's hiding in plain sight. You may have seen that button before, maybe not. Definitely worth playing around with during your lunch break one day. And it does automatic color coding to your cells. So I did not sit down with this spreadsheet and fill in each cell one at a time. That would have taken too long. So instead, I just used the conditional formatting feature and let it do it for me. Sometimes I decide to actually use this conditional formatting as my final product or as my final deliverable. So this Excel spreadsheet, you can see I adjusted the print settings, I added a title, I made sure it fit neatly on one page, and then I might print that and actually just bring that to a staff meeting with me. You also might want to consult a chart taxonomy or a data visualization taxonomy as you're thinking about chart types. So the most common one that I'm sure you're familiar with is Excel's menu of chart types. This is a good starting point, but keep in mind you can only really use maybe 5 of these charts, so you're not going to make one of those, you know, 3D cylindrical kind of cylinder-shaped things. You're not going to make any 3D pyramids or anything that's going to be really hard to understand. You're just going to be sticking with the basics here. So not every chart type known to mankind is in this Excel's menu, but it's still a really good starting point. I also really like this chart suggestions diagram. This was created by Andrew Abella. He's a business professor at Catholic University in DC. He has this PDF available on his website, extremepresentation.com. So you can go to his website, download it for free. I used to have it taped above my desk, and I would kind of glance up at it when I was sketching out my charts and use it for inspiration. Since he has a business background and I'm primarily working with like school boards and nonprofits and foundations, you know, I can't apply all of these chart types to my own work, but there's still a lot of the chart types that I can use, and it's still a good starting place. My friend John Schwabisch, who I mentioned earlier, produced the graphic continuum last summer and fall. He was working on it, so it's pretty new. He has it on his website, policyviz.com, and it's big. It's a huge poster. You can see him kind of holding it up here. Since he has an economics and policy background, I can apply most of these chart types to my own work. That's why I really like it. And I was teasing him when he released this, you know, John, I don't have any more office wall space. I just don't have space for this poster. Can you make a smaller version? And he humored me, and he made these little, like, 8.5 by 11 inch laminated reference cards. So they're front and back, and it's kind of the same chart types that are on this poster, a really similar layout that you can also buy if you want. I think the poster is about $20. The reference cards are about $10. So you can see that this is what DataViz nerds like me do for fun. Let's pretend that your husband or spouse went out of town for a week and you knew you'd have your house to yourself. So what I did, instead of binge watching my favorite TV show, which I probably should have done, or gone out with my girlfriends, I sat down and I sketched all of the charts that I use on a regular basis on 3.5 by 5 inch index cards. And I thought about when to use them, like a scatter plot and a bubble chart, kind of what made those different. And I sketched out twice as many charts as are shown here. It was my whole living room carpet was just covered in data and charts. And I grouped them over and over. So I thought about, okay, these charts are really good for qualitative or text-based data. And these are really good for graphing patterns over time, like 1 point in time or 2 points in time or 3 points in time. And these are really good for showing some type of range or distribution or spread. So I grouped and grouped and grouped and sorted and sorted and sorted. And then I got to the end of the week and I thought, geez, what am I going to do with all these charts? I can't just leave these on my living room floor. My husband will be pretty angry coming home to this mess. So I made this website. You know, I wanted people like you to be able to interact with the charts on your own, just like I had. I tried a PowerPoint slide. I tried mind mapping software. Nothing worked. I needed something interactive that people could play with. So this is free online. It's annkemery.com/essentials, and it lists out all the little chart types and little icons. And there are filters at the top. So you might say, hey, Ann, I just want to look at patterns over time. Show me the line chart family. And you would see options like the line chart or the slope chart or a panel chart. Or you might say, hey, Ann, I really want to see graphs that are really good for graphing some type of range or a distribution or a spread or a deviation in my data. So you would see options like the histogram or the population pyramid or the box and whisker plot, which you probably remember from high school or college statistics. And then when you see a graph type that you're curious about, you want to learn more about that type, maybe it's a new type for you, you can click on one of the icons and you're led to your own, you know, a separate page for that graph type. You see a little description or a definition about what that chart type is, some words of wisdom about when to use it or not use it. In a lot of cases, I link to tutorials, to examples out in the real world of people using that graph type in their research reports. And the photo carousel also loops through all the examples of that chart type. So if you click on the spark lines and spark bars, you would see examples of that chart type kind of out in the wild being used. So you can see how you might apply it to your own project. Paul says, that looks like my floor. Yes, I'm not claiming to have a perfectly clean house all the time, but I rarely have note cards that many strewn around the floor. Okay, so I'm not going to show you all these chart types today. I'm just going to show you some highlights. So if you remember nothing else from today's webinar, I hope you remember this chart, the dot plot, which is really kind of the platinum standard for charts, the absolute best chart type to rule chart types. And that's because there's a lot of research behind it showing that our brains do really well interpreting these dots along a line. Now, this is a newer chart type for a lot of people, so I'm going to show you where it comes from. So let's think back to a traditional bar chart for a moment. Where do your eyes go when you look at this bar chart? All of the, you know, the whole left-hand side is all standard or uniform, so your eyes don't go there. What you're doing is looking along the right side of the graph, and you're kind of following that jagged edge down, comparing the lengths of the bars to each other. So dot plots, somehow they know. They've got ESP. They get inside your brain. They know you're going to be looking at that outer end of the bars. So they go ahead and stick a dot or a circle at the end of the bars. And then you would peel away the bars, and you're left with the dot plot. Now, this wouldn't be your final finished product. It looks pretty bare there on the page. So you have to add back in some of the contextual details. So you'd add the axes at the bottom. You'd add some more labels like this. You could use dot plots for 1 point in time, like year one of a grant, to show how different grantees are doing. Or you could use them for 2 points in time. So they're kind of like a line graph in this sense. People can look at just the gray dots for year one, or they could look at just the black dots for year two, or more importantly, they can look at the distance in between the bars and compare and see how well organizations fared over time. My favorite use of dot plots is for triangulation. So let's say you're surveying two or three different groups of people. You might want to compare how the principals responded and how the teachers responded. And again, you get to see where their viewpoints converge or come together, or where they have diverging or opposing viewpoints on some issue. So if dot plots are my favorite, I would have to say clustered bar charts are my absolute least favorite chart of all. And here's why. Nobody can read these. I used to get really intimidated looking at this, and I would think, geez, I've taken about a million research methods classes. Why can't I make sense of this? But nobody can. And this is what your brain would have to do. So you'd have to say, okay, brain, focus. Just look at the blue bars. And you'd look at the blue bar and compare it to the blue bar and compare it to the blue bar. And then you'd have to say, okay, brain, focus. Come on, you can do this. And you'd have to look at the red bar and the red bar and the red bar. And then this is where it gets really hard. You'd have to say, okay, brain, compare the red to the blue, and the blue to the red, and the red to the green, and the green to the purple, and so on and so on until you want to bang your head against the wall. It's just impossible to read. So take a good look at this before graph, and I'm going to show you the after. Here's the remake, a small multiples bar chart. So small multiples are when you have several of the same graph type all aligned on one page. They're all the same shape and same size. They help you disaggregate data so you can look at just one of these categories at a time. Clustered bar charts aren't always bad, but the rule is two bars. Two bars is really the max here. Maybe three, maybe if you want to, you know, kind of cheat a little bit, but two bars tend to be the easiest to look at. The only problem with these is that people use clustered bar charts all the time. So reports typically go like this. They're like clustered bar chart, stacked bar chart, clustered bar chart, stacked bar chart. And it gets really monotonous after a while. So I'm going to show you a couple alternatives here. Since this one is looking at pre and post data, so we've got two different points in time, you could show that exact same data set in a slope chart, which is kind of like a line chart. It just has two points in time, so a starting point and then an ending point over here, like pre-intervention, post-intervention. And the viewers get to look at the angle of that slope. Is it a really steep slope, lots of improvements? Is it more of a medium slope? Is it just a going downward slope over time? Or you could show that same exact data set in a dot plot, or good friend a dot plot. Same thing, all fair game here. Okay, so let's dive into tools. I'm going to talk about just a couple of tools here, not an exhaustive list, but my favorites. So Excel, Tableau, and R. Now, people always ask me, Anne, which tool should I use? What's the best tool of all? Can you recommend just the perfect tool? I only want to use one. And I tell them, in all seriousness, you already have the perfect tool. It really is your brain. Your brain is the most powerful data visualization tool of all. And here's why. There are a couple things that your brain can do that no software program can do for you. So your brain is the only tool that can help you figure out whether you're going to use a traditional line chart, like the one on the left, or a slope chart like the one on the right, where maybe you're purposely and intentionally just showing the bigger picture to your viewers. Maybe you want people to see all those peaks and valleys over time, or maybe you want them to focus on just the big picture, just the beginning and endpoints. There's no right or wrong answer here. It's really apples and oranges. But again, your brain is the only tool that can make this decision. Your brain's also the only tool that can decide whether you're going to show one aggregated graph, like the one on the right, or the one on the left, or a lot of disaggregated graphs in a small multiples layout like the one on the right. Again, there's no kind of right answer. It's going to depend on your viewers. Do they want just one single graph? Do they want to look at each organization or each company or each university separately? You know, there's no way to tell. It's just something you're going to have to think about with your colleagues and come up with the best answer. So if your brain's the best tool, I'd have to say Excel is probably second best. And Excel sometimes gets a bad reputation for data visualization. You know, and here's why. People think about the default charts. They think about the 3D exploding pie chart or the clustered bar chart, which, you know, of course, is my favorite, sure. But I'm not talking about default Excel charts. I'm talking about very carefully making some adjustments to the default settings. So getting in there, you know, removing the border, removing the tick marks, removing the grid lines, tweaking the colors, adding a title, making it as easy to understand as possible. You might also want to try your hand at Tableau. Some of the graphs look like this. Here's kind of a sample from their website so you can get a feel for how it might be similar or different to Excel. There are two versions of Tableau. So there's Tableau Public, which is the free version. It's kind of like a trial version. It's got a lot of good features, though. And there's Tableau Desktop, which is the paid version. The last time I checked, it was about $2,000 per license per year. So it's, you know, definitely kind of a costly software program for a lot of the groups that I know. So a major, major word of caution here, and I learned this the hard way. Tableau Public means your data is public. It is absolutely public. People can go on the internet and see all the data that you upload into the site as you're using the public version. So a few years ago, I was encouraging one of our research assistants in our company to, you know, go explore Tableau for the afternoon, try it out. So he comes back to me about 20 minutes later, and he was like, "Anne, I tried Tableau, so great. I love the software program. I learned a lot already in just 20 minutes. And I said, "Great, Dan, like, which data set did you use? Which data set are you playing around with?" And he said, "I'm using the substance abuse counseling data from our company." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, you know, and I kind of had a heart attack there, and I still really get nervous when I think about this, because he uploaded ID numbers, names, social security numbers, birthdays, substance abuse counseling diagnoses, case notes, addresses, like phone numbers, everything that you would never, ever want anybody to see, let alone for it to be open to the whole internet. So we went online, you know, we removed everything almost instantly, but I still get really nervous thinking about this. We probably could have been sued for that. We probably still could be sued, because they go around the country, like, telling this story about this, you know, horrible thing that happened because we didn't know any better. So please be very careful with, you know, your data. You have to scrub it and clean it and take off any identifying information before you use this public version, which is why a lot of people who have sensitive data do go ahead and just upgrade and get the paid version, so they don't have to worry about this as much. If you want to get started with Tableau, you can just go online, download it. They have a lot of really great video tutorials, so you kind of watch the video, play around with their sample data set, watch the video, play around with their sample data set. I'd say it takes about a day, probably about a full workday, kind of start to finish. You won't be an expert at the end of that workday, but you will be, you know, farther along, probably an intermediate level if you watch all their videos. And the third program worth knowing about is R, just the letter R. It's an open source software program. It's really great for interactive graphics, really great for big data sets. It does both data management and data analysis and data visualizations. It's kind of the full range of things that you might need this tool for. But the word of caution with R is that it's a programming language. So if you have a background in computer science, or maybe you've used statistical packages like SAS or M+ to have more of this kind of open screen layout, go for it. You know, if you're really comfortable writing code or modifying code that others have written. But if you don't have any coding background, this probably is not the right software program for you. If you want to get started, my resource recommendation is a person, not a book or a blog or a website. Tony Fuge, who I used to work with, he's a practitioner, so he's the director of learning and evaluation at a large nonprofit in DC. But he also teaches R a lot. It's kind of like his extra hobby or kind of on-the-side project that he does for the betterment of the R community. We presented at a conference a couple of years ago together about how to climb the R learning curve without falling off the cliff. And Tony went through all of the dozens and hundreds of resources that are online. He spelled them out really carefully. So he said, like, step one, do this. Step two, do this. Step three, do this. And it's on this resource page, which is on my blog for free. You can check it out if you want. Okay, so step five, you've made your chart in your software program of choice. Now you need to go in there and do some formatting. So no software program is perfect. Hopefully, you know, you get that takeaway message today. You are going to have to do a few manual adjustments to make sure everything's easy to read. About a year ago, my colleague Stephanie Evergreen and I published the Data Visualization Checklist. So we took all of the best practices from all of the data viz gurus and experts out there. So we took you know, advice from our blogs and books, from other people's blogs and books, from all the research that's out there, put it into one 25-item checklist. It's arranged in a few different categories: text, arrangement, color, lines, overall considerations. And you can rate or score your graph 2, 1, or 0, depending on how well it fits that guideline. So it's made more of a tool that you can use for self-improvement and check your own work. I'm not going to cover all 25 guidelines, but I'm going to cover kind of 4 or 5 of them that I think are going to give you the biggest bang for your buck. So here's the first one. You want to mute your grid lines. This is the absolute first tweak that I do to any graph. So I take away the border, I take away the grid lines, I take away those little tick marks, which are those little like vertical or horizontal hash marks in there. I don't necessarily remove every single line. Sometimes I'm lightening them or muting them. Like the one on the bottom is a scatter plot. And if I would have removed the X and Y axis there, I don't think you would know that it was a scatter plot necessarily. You kind of needed those lines. But the one on the left is black, and then the one on the left is gray. So they're lightened, so they kind of fade into the background. The viewer gets to focus right on the data and not be distracted by any extra lines or ink on the page. Okay, so I'll show you how this works. Let's say you're creating some type of handout or maybe a graph on a slide like this. You want to have a small multiples layout. You're going to have 9 different graphs so people can see all these differences. This is the final version, so there are no grid lines whatsoever on the page. But by default, Excel wanted to add these vertical grid lines, nice, thick, black, super ugly grid lines to the page. And older versions of Excel would have also added vertical grid lines, so it gets a little bit harder to read. And if I would have produced a line chart instead of that area chart, it would have looked like this. So it's almost impossible to see the data. It's like trying to look at your data through a tennis racket. You can't see it at all. And how are people supposed to make decisions based on your data if they can't even see it? So that's why in this final version, I went ahead and just removed the grid lines altogether. I could have kept them and just made sure they were really, really light gray if I wanted to too. That would have also been fine. Removing the border, so that kind of goes hand in hand with the grid lines, the same idea that you want to remove any ink that doesn't have a very specific purpose. So here's the before version. Let's say you're looking at some type of two-column page in your report. The graph has a border around it, so it looks a little bit separate from the rest of the text. Here's the after. It's a very, very faint difference. Watch for it. Super faint difference, very, very minor, but it does help. It helps blend in the quantitative numbers and the qualitative numbers and tell one cohesive story. A friend of mine said, this is like reading a children's book to her kids at night. When you're teaching your kids to read and they're kind of making sense of the words and the sentences for the first time, it's not like you go through a kid's book and you see really thick borders around each of the illustrations. Of course not, because you want the words and the pictures to blend in together and be one story. Titles. Okay, so you're going to aim for a 6 to 12 word descriptive title. The one on the left is a generic kind of researchy, jargony sounding title, figure 2A, ice cream flavor preferences, blah, 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 you know, N equals 216. The one on the right uses more everyday language, layperson language, and it's descriptive. So you actually state the graph's key finding or its elevator pitch right in the title itself. Chocolate is most popular ice cream flavor. Really, really simple. 6 to 12 words seems to be about the right length. So if you go after today's webinar, go look at any magazine article or any newspaper article and count up how many words are in that title. You're going to see almost all of them fit that kind of 6 to 12 word sweet spot. You also want to make sure that your chart titles are left justified. So they're not centered right above the graph, but they're over to the left and then with the graph kind of down below it. And that's because, of course, in Western cultures, think about how we read a page. So we've got our typical page or reading, you know, in a book. And you start in the upper left and you kind of read across and you read across and you read across. So people's eye movements with all the eye tracking research we have show that they're going to look in the upper left-hand corner first. So place your title there and you'll guarantee that people see it. It grabs their attention. Titles are really important because they help with skimming. So we've kind of established already, people are not going to read your full document from start to finish. They're going to kind of flip around. All of the visual elements are going to catch their eye. So they're going to look at your photos, your stock photos, your diagrams, your call-out boxes with quotes, all of your graphs. Anything that's kind of visual and stands out is going to catch their attention. So by putting the title right next to the graph, you guarantee that even as they're skimming, they're going to still kind of glance at that title. It's not lost forever. And they're going to still walk away having remembered some of the key messages from your report. I'm usually not writing any titles from scratch. I kind of usually read the paragraph above and the paragraph below, and I just pick out what seems to be the main message there, and I just copy and paste that text, and I stick it right next to the chart itself. Subtitles and annotations are pretty cool. So subtitles would be the number of U.S. measles cases declined dramatically, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be one or two lines or one or two sentences that adds extra contextual information. An annotation is a little call-out box or text box on the graph. So the annotation at this point is that red dot that says measles vaccine introduced. It's a pretty key piece of information there. So if you're trying to think about, you know, how measles cases increased or decreased over time and what's the story there. A pretty crucial piece of information, obviously, is when did the vaccine get introduced? When did it come about? How did it make the measles cases decline so dramatically there? Sometimes this is the really obvious information that, you know, as you're the one working in the data or working on the project, you kind of forget about these details because they're just so obvious to somebody familiar with the project. So don't be afraid to put something as obvious as like when the vaccine was introduced right on your graph. It's nothing fancy if I'm working in PowerPoint or Excel or Word. It's just a little, you know, typical text box like you would usually use. So speaking of text, we want to make sure our text is horizontal. So this one works. We've got increased knowledge, improved attitudes, changed behavior. It's all horizontal. They're all on one line. But sometimes as your graph gets narrower, Excel will start to wrap the text. So this one's still readable. It just looks, you know, not quite as nice or not as polished because we've got one of the labels on two lines and the others are just on one line. And then hopefully you haven't seen this before in too many published reports. I know I have. I cringe every time I see this. If your chart gets too narrow, Excel will actually tilt the text to the side and makes it diagonal, and it cuts off the labels. It'll just say dot, dot, dot. So it gets harder to read because, of course, you don't want people to have to tilt their head to the side to read your report. That would be crazy. Sometimes this happens if I'm trying to make a small multiples layout, and I've got a lot of charts I need to fit on one page. I just kind of run out of space after a while. So the easiest solution is to flip that chart that had up and down bars, vertical bars, and just flip it to the side and make some horizontal bars this time. Now you've got plenty of space for the labels off to the left. You can use as many inches on the page as you need to make sure that those labels aren't cut off. Intentional ordering. This is a big thing, especially with bar charts. So this one is not intentionally ordered. If you take a look at those categories on the left, they're actually ordered alphabetically. So we've got the B's up at the top and the S way down at the bottom. Probably the analyst just, you know, didn't think about it much. They just kind of ordered them in the same order as whatever survey or whatever kind of assessment tool they were using. Intentional ordering would look something like this, either greatest to least or least to greatest. So you're helping people spot the patterns right off the bat. So we've got the biggest group, 79 at the top, the smallest group, 4% at the bottom. I've also tweaked the title so there's good consistency between the title and the ordering. So it says most common data collection approaches used, because of course we've got the most common ones at the bottom. It doesn't always have to be greatest to least. It could be least to greatest. Maybe you want to draw people's eyes to the smallest groups first. That's completely fine. But again, make sure you've got that consistency between your title and your graph. So this one, of course, from the title talks about least common because we've got the least common or the lowest numbers up at the top. And the last one I'll talk about today is color. So there are two main things to keep in mind with color. The first one is intentional color scheme. So hopefully the word intentional is sticking out in your mind a lot today. Not just randomly kind of throwing graphs on a page, but using a lot of planning and thinking behind them. These color schemes are not intentional. You're not allowed to use these. Excel's default blues and reds and greens and oranges. I used to use these all the time for what I thought was a very good reason. I made a lot of blue charts because my boss's favorite color was blue, and kind of everybody in our consulting firm just made blue graphs to keep the boss happy. Even though one of our clients who we're working for most of the time, their logo was black and yellow, black and yellow logo, but we made all these random blue graphs. Our consulting firm's logo wasn't even blue. It was just that, you know, we didn't know any better yet, so we just made blue after blue after blue graphs. What you're going to do instead is match your color scheme to somebody's logo. So if you're a consultant and you're producing graphs for other people, you're probably going to match your client's logo. If you work, you know, if your viewers are inside of your organization, you're probably going to use your own organization's color scheme to really enhance that branding that goes across. So usually what I'll do is I'll go to the group's website, I look at their logo, I look at kind of their major like web layout. I might download a report or two, like an annual report that a graphic designer made for them. And I get a sense for the look and feel of their charts and for their other kind of visual elements, and I try to replicate that look and feel in my graphs and in my slides. You don't have to make up any of these color schemes. You can actually use something like this. So groups with, let's say if you have like maybe 10 staff or more in your organization, you probably have a style guide or a style sheet. It's usually a one-page PDF. It's usually made by a professional graphic designer. The communications specialist in your organization might have this. It tells you things like a primary color scheme, maybe a secondary color scheme, the exact fonts that you can be using in your report and in your graphs. And it specifies, most importantly, the color codes. So it gives you RGB codes, red, green, blue codes, which are the language that Excel needs to read. So you just kind of type those codes in your graph and use it to tweak the color scheme. Okay, so here's how it works. I went to George Mason for grad school, UVA for undergrad, of course. And when I was doing my big research project and I had to propose my research project, I used Mason colors, the green and yellow, in all of my slides and in my document. And there's a nice consistency. You can see it looks like a kind of a nice George Mason research study. And then a couple years later, it came time to defend my work, and I said, geez, you know, I hate the color green. It reminds me of the carpet in the house that I was growing up in. I just hate that color green. So I used blue and purple just because I like those colors. And it doesn't look the same. You can see, like, it's similar graphs, similar kind of like layout and design. All that's different is the color, but you really lose a lot of the branding and the identity if you don't use the same color scheme as the organization there. Okay, last tip for today. This is also related to color, so it's about highlighting key patterns. Let's say you have a line graph like this. You can see the little gray lines in the background of your slide there. There's a lot of different lines, a lot of different stuff going on. You can't label or color in every single line. So what I'll usually do is I might highlight the biggest line on the graph or the biggest line in the bar chart or, you know, something I'm interested in with a bolder, like thicker line and a deeper saturated color. That's your highlighting color. I might also highlight the smallest line in the graph. And I might highlight one in the middle. So I'm the co-chair of this data visualization group within a professional society. And I wanted to know how many members we had, how are we doing. We're a pretty new organization, or a pretty new group. We just got started in 2012. So you can see 2011, you know, we had 0 members on that graph. And I wanted to see kind of how we stacked up, how popular we were in comparison to the other groups. So that's why I just looked at, you know, the biggest group, the smallest group, and then ours in the middle. The other gray lines are there as contextual information, as secondary kind of backup information. You see this highlighting technique used a lot out in the wild. So when the iPhone 6 came out last fall, everybody was talking about the screen size, of course, and how the iPhone 6 had these monster-sized screens. So I saw a lot of people talking on Twitter or in newspapers about, you know, the screen size, of course. So what did they highlight? The iPhone 6, and the other tablet sizes and phones are there just as background information. I saw this also recently in a Slate article that was talking about Craigslist missed connections. And the article was talking about how in certain areas of the country, like in the South or you know, in the West up there, a lot of people had reported you know, seeing the love of their life, eyeing that gorgeous guy or gorgeous girl from across Walmart and kind of pining after them and going online and writing a little Craigslist missed connection about how they wanted to try to connect with this guy or girl. So of course, what are they highlighting in the graph? Not every single, you know, place where you could meet somebody is color-coded, just Walmart to draw attention to the Walmart finding there. Okay, so we made it to the end of the webinar. Hopefully you got a good feel for the big picture thinking process. So thinking about your audience, thinking about your communications mode or dissemination format you're going to use, thinking about what chart type you might use, thinking about which software tool is most appropriate, and then finally thinking about what types of tweaks or adjustments you need to make to your chart to make sure that it's easy to read. So if you have any questions now, go ahead and type them in the chat box. I'll pick off just a few of them. We'll probably have a lot of questions coming in. And I'll hang out until at least probably 1:15. So if you want to hang around past 1, go for it. I'll be here answering questions.
Anne, thank you so much for that wonderful presentation. I know I've learned a great deal myself. We wanted to thank everyone who's joined us today while your questions are coming in. We just wanted to thank you for coming and joining us today. I wanted to mention our next Friday Forum webinar that's coming up on June 12th. Jamie Conklin will be presenting Spotlight on a Career in Data Science. So I'm going to turn it back over to Anne for some questions, but if any of you need to leave right now, we just wanted to thank you again for joining us today. And please remember to complete the Friday Forum survey when you receive the recording later this afternoon.
Somebody's asking about the data visualization checklist, which has all those best practices that I talked about just towards the end. Yes, it's available online. It's on my website. I typed in the URL into the chat box. It's also on Stephanie Evergreen's website, who is kind of the co-producer of that checklist. And somebody's commenting that, yes, the checklist also includes how to make information accessible to different types of learners or people with visual disabilities. So part of the color section, of course, is about how to make your charts readable for people with color blindness or how to make charts readable if they're going to be printed or photocopied in black and white. There are a lot of resources online, too, about color blindness and black-white printing. So definitely check those out if those are some people that you're making graphs for. I see a lot of thank yous and thank yous and thank yous, but not as many questions or comments. So if you're still hanging around, I would love to hear from you one last time. I would love to hear your main takeaway message or the most interesting thing you learned, the biggest kind of nugget you're going to use in your work, some skill you want to pursue or learn more about. So kind of let me know if there's something that stuck with you or a main takeaway that you have. The webinar recording will be shared. I don't share the slides, but you will receive a handout that goes through kind of the major resources in this presentation. And I'd say probably half of these techniques I've also written blog posts about too. So if there's something that caught your eye, you can go read through it at your own pace and get even more details online. How does Tableau compare to Spotfire? I've never heard of Spotfire before. I do about a million trainings on this a year. Nobody's ever asked. So you'll have to let me know. Go explore Tableau on your own and kind of let me know the pros and cons and which one you think works best for you. Somebody's saying that their company's main logo color is red. I'd like to use red, but wouldn't an all red chart be aggressive or strain the eye? Yeah, I mean, it could be. Maybe are you going to use red as maybe your highlighting color? Maybe you have kind of like a gray graph and red is just here and there to highlight some key findings, like the highlighting technique. You probably have another, I would think, a secondary color in your logo, or you could talk to a graphic designer or communications specialist in your organization, ask them for advice about kind of a secondary complement color that you could use, so it's not just like red, red, red over and over. There are definitely some cultural considerations to all color, you know, so of course if you see a pink graph, usually think of like girls or women or something feminine. A red graph could definitely be seen as aggressive or sometimes, shining a spotlight on something that isn't going well. I do have some examples on my blog about using a burgundy color scheme, which was the main logo color of a client that I was working with, too. So try it out a couple different ways. You don't have to just have like bright red in your face all the time, of course. John's saying he has half a table, so about a 4-foot-wide table, to present at a function next week. What visuals should I use? Maybe a poster board. Yeah, you're probably going to need something really big. What visuals? I guess it depends. I don't know who your audience is, what message you're trying to get across. I've seen some people print poster-sized infographics, you know, so they can have like maybe each little graph within there is still pretty large, so people can read it as they're quickly walking by. I've seen some people at functions. Especially if you are doing something like a software, like you're selling a software program, you'd actually have a live laptop there where you could demo the software and play around with the data and see how it looks on the actual computer screen. Really, the possibilities are endless, too, with what types of handouts you could produce. So a lot could work there, I think, for your function, John. Takeaway messages, dot plots, yes. Please check them out. Aaliyah says her takeaway message is, you don't have to be stuck with graphs you hate. There are ways to make them easier to view. Yes, absolutely. I don't think anybody makes graphs on purpose that other people are going to hate. I think usually they just haven't been exposed to this data visualization field yet. They don't know there's a better way of presenting information. You know, they just haven't learned it yet. They're kind of still in the dark. And that's fine, you know, so just kind of know if you see a graph you hate. It's not that somebody's like doing it on purpose just to annoy you. I've never seen that happen, actually. What's the link to the New York Times map? Okay, let me try to find the New York Times map. It's called Mapping America, Every City, Every Block. And I see it right here. I'm going to type this into the chat window now. New York Times interactive map. There are a lot of good ones. The New York Times graphics team is certainly the leader in all sorts of interactive graphics. Other journalism teams are doing a good job too, but they're the ones that at the DataViz conferences, you know, they win all the awards, they're noticed all the time, they're really doing groundbreaking work. So a great thing to follow, a great group to follow. Holly's asking, what academic or formal training did you receive to gain your DataViz skills, or did you learn it all by experience? So I kind of became aware of data visualization not too long ago. I think I heard the term the first time, maybe in 2011 or 12. I went to a full-day training by Andy Kirk, who I mentioned. I went to a half-day training shortly after that by Cole Nussbaumer. As I was going to any types of conferences, I was kind of naturally was interested in this. You know, I didn't want all my data to be hidden in bad graphs or just tossed aside in 100-page reports. So I was very eager to make better ways to communicate my graphs, and I would seek out any conference sessions that talked about graphs or dashboards or anything kind of on the visual spectrum there. And then, you know, I just started teaching myself. So I read some of Edward Tufte's books. I read Alberto Cairo has a book out. Well, I read a couple chapters of it. A lot of it was very focused on journalism. I read my friend Stephanie Evergreen's book. And then I make graphics probably, I do about half-time data visualization training like this and about half-time research consulting. So I'd try out all these techniques with the groups that I was working with and, you know, just try it and try it and try it, trial and error over and over and over. And then about a year ago, I realized, okay, I think like I've learned all I can learn from other people. I'm ready to go teach other people what I've learned and went independent. So I'd say most of the people are self-taught. If anybody says they have kind of formal training, you know, the formal training is really just happening now. Some universities are just starting to have kind of a data science group, or maybe it's within their school of journalism, some type of data visualization course. But this is really only within the past year or two. I mean, it really is brand new. I don't know if UVA has any courses yet or any professors who specialize in this. I'm not sure. So it's really like brand new, kind of the formal training. So it's mostly going to be like pre-conference workshops at a conference, or people like me going around and training companies, online webinars like this. Blogs are a great source of DataViz inspiration. The hashtag DataViz on Twitter, DataViz, or VIS if you want to follow like Andy Kirk in London, of course. And I follow all the data journalism people on Twitter, kind of craft my feed. There's some Pinterest boards about data visualization that I follow for inspiration, too. Okay, well, I think that's the end of our questions. If you typed one in that maybe I didn't see as I was kind of zooming through the chat window right now, certainly reach out. I've got my email address up on the slide right now. So reach out anytime with questions or comments. And I hope you learned a lot. I hope you feel inspired to go continue learning after today and communicate your data even better in the graphs that you're making. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us today. We really appreciate your presentation. It was wonderful. Thanks again to everyone who joined us today. We appreciate your spending lunch with us, and we hope you'll join us again on June 12th for our next Friday Forum webinar. Thank you all. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.